Amazing. Okay. All right. So let's keep going. So what makes for a good surrogate? Even before we get to the sort of local enterprise for in within the Jewish community, those who are Torah observant, selecting a surrogate, finding someone to be a surrogate is not an easy task. The guidelines here are from the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, which are sort of followed and or mimicked in a number of context, a number of jurisdictions as even legal requirements. There's a lot that we set a high bar in many, certainly many of the much of the developed world for who qualifies to be a surrogate. Broadly speaking, you want to make sure that it's someone who is capable, that we're confident there have the physical, emotional, financial capacity to carry a pregnancy, to carry a fetus to term. And so there are all sorts of thresholds that have to be met in terms of oftentimes there's an expectation that a surrogate has carried their own pregnancy to term in the past, that they're in good health by all sorts of metrics, that they are financially stable, and so on. And then there is a question that's been posed by a number of scholars as to is it on the one hand setting this high bar ensures the tries to protect against people putting themselves into the field of surrogacy in out of desperation, right? We can imagine that, and we'll discuss this towards the end of the shiur, that there's a lot of money in surrogacy, and so we can imagine a world in which people are very eager to take part of this, even if they don't necessarily have the physical or emotional or financial capacity to do so. And so in order to both ensure that the fetus comes out okay, but also make sure that there isn't undue exploitation, in the surrogacy market, standards are often set very high. We'll discuss in the later part of this year whether there are downsides to that. But in the, even on top of all these thresholds, within the halachic framework, there are two other questions that have to be considered. And those would be one, is it preferable to have someone who is Jewish or not Jewish? And two, is it preferable to have someone who is married or unmarried? Those are two questions that we have to consider. Again, we could formulate it as which is preferable or even what's allowed. Is it permissible to have a Jewish or a non-Jewish surrogate? Is it permissible to have a married or unmarried surrogate, as the case may be? So that's what I want to look at today. And how some of the discourse around this is continuing to change, even to this day, as cultural norms seem to be adapting. Okay. Preliminarily, let's see if I can do this here. No, okay. So preliminarily, what's really interesting when you look at the conversation in the halakha context, oops, sorry. Is that the way that the conversation looks depends a little bit on what part of the world you're in. We don't obviously, you know, in a shiur like this, don't have the opportunity to look at all that has been written and said on a complex issue like surrogacy. But just taking some pieces that I hope will sort of bring the ideas to the fore. So an article that came out in 2013 by John Loika, who's has a medical background, and Rav Moshe Tendler, who has both a rabbinic and medical background, on questions around surrogacy, writes as follows. In summary, as we mentioned, there's a great deal that they wrote before, but in summary, the various reasons, they list four, I'll get to them in a moment, may be sufficient on the grounds to discourage or even prohibit infertile couples from procuring a Jewish woman as their surrogate. And Dr. Loika and Rav Tendler are very clear about the fact that they think that it is highly, highly preferable in the event that a person, a family, is looking to use the assistance of a surrogate in bringing a child into the world, it is highly preferable, maybe even obligatory, to only do so with a non-Jewish surrogate rather than with a Jewish surrogate. And they list four possible issues that can come up, namely the laws of Erevah, the possibility of producing non-genetic krovim, the prohibition of self-injury, and the potential risk of infidelity between the genetic father and the surrogate. I don't want to give you all their text, but I'll just walk through what they have in mind. I'm going to go backwards. Okay, the potential risk for infidelity between the genetic father and the surrogate. I don't know where they got this from. They write that there is evidence that can happen sometimes that the genetic father gets really excited knowing that the surrogate is carrying his genetic child in her body, and that'll make them get really close to each other, and then there could be infidelity, and it'll ruin the marriage. And they said, we have evidence this has happened. Okay, maybe they heard of a case or two, but there's a lot of cases of surrogacy in the world where that does not happen. So I have a hard time, getting too worked up about that particular concern. But they list it as an issue. Okay, moving right back. The prohibition of self-injury. This is an interesting one, which is, in principle, it is prohibited to cause harm to yourself. This is a key issue that comes up in the later big discussion of the world of Nisikina of damages. It's not exactly clear where this prohibition emerges from in the Torah, and the Torah doesn't say explicitly that you can't cause self-harm, but it's pretty much agreed upon in later rabbinic writing that you're not allowed to cause harm to yourself knowingly or willingly. And there are questions that come up, for example, about cosmetic surgery. Is it permissible to undergo cosmetic surgery knowing that you are doing harm to yourself, even putting yourself at risk, when there isn't necessarily a clear need? Now, it is definitely the case that you're allowed to cause harm or put yourself at risk under certain circumstances, if you are trying to save yourself, right, if you need surgery, or maybe even to save others, depending on the professional field that you're in. But it's funny to say that there should be a prohibition of self-injury for a surrogate, meaning, again, the surrogate would be taking on certain risks, right? Any pregnancy comes with certain kinds of risks that are involved. And there can be, physical, emotional, financial, repercussions that could emerge, something goes wrong with that pregnancy. But it's funny to think that there would be a prohibition of self-injury, that the prohibition of self-injury would mean that one can't be a surrogate. Why is that? Anybody want to throw out an answer? Why might it be the case? I'll just clarify the question. Why might it be the case that it's difficult to claim that the prohibition of self-injury is a reason why you can't be a surrogate?
Because pregnancy is a risk.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Yeah, if the prohibition of self-injury means that you can't be a surrogate, it also means that you can't be a mother ever, meaning that you can't be a birthing mother, I should say. Right? It's not only an issue for surrogates, it's an issue for anyone who wants to become pregnant. And it seems hard to believe that it would be prohibited to become pregnant. That
Well,
seems to run counter to basically anything we know about the Torah.
but there are some additional risks with the kind of the IVF implanting an embryo than just pregnancy, getting pregnant in the normal way.
For sure, there the hyperstimulation of the uterus in order to allow for it to, accept
Yeah.
the I'm sorry, the embryo right there. There are issues that could come up. The question is it how much risk is there in a case of surrogacy that there isn't in a case of pregnancy, a sort of a traditional case of pregnancy, I should say. And is that difference enough? Because if not, then it should be prohibited to become pregnant. Now, Rav Tendler, tries to argue that it's different because in a case where a person becomes pregnant, meaning in the context of, in the context of their own, within a marriage, so then what you are engaging in is the mitzvah of puravim. There's a mitzvah, presumably, to bring children into the world. How exactly we navigate what constitutes the mitzvah of puravim is a funny question. Because there are all these weird technicalities. For example, there's a notion that only men are obligated in puravim. I'm not sure how anybody planned to have children that way. There's this thing about you only fulfill a mitzvah if you have a boy and a girl. Okay, what sort of control do we have over that? So again, the mitzvah of puravim is an unusual one. But Rav Moshe Tendler claims that in as much as within the context of a marriage, this couple, this family has an obligation of puravim, that mitzvah of puravim overrides the prohibition of the risk of self-injury. But, says Rav Tendler, that's not true for the surrogate. Meaning the surrogate, he claims, is not fulfilling the mitzvah of puravim, is not engaged in the mitzvah of bringing their own children into the world. And therefore, in such a case, the prohibition of self-injury would override the permission to start a pregnancy. It's an interesting argument. I will admit that I'm skeptical about it. Number one, it's a good question. Is it permissible to become pregnant despite the risk of self-injury only because of a mitzvah, or do we simply say that, as we know from elsewhere in halakha, there's a presumption that though pregnancy can be dangerous, in the significant majority of cases, certainly in the world in which we live today, pregnancies end okay, and birthing mothers come out okay, such that, it's a what we might call a risk worth taking. And two, I wonder whether we're right to say that the surrogate has no fulfillment in the mitzvah of Peru. At the very least, we should say that the surrogate is misaya or misayat, is facilitating or assisting in the mitzvah of Peru, even if not fulfilling the mitzvah on her own. I'm skeptical about the injury too, how much that really needs to be a concern. I think the strong arguments that he raises are points one and two. Point two is the possibility of producing non-genetic proven. What he means by this is that, as we discussed in the past, there's some disagreement about, in the event that you have a gestational mother and a genetic mother, meaning the person who provides the egg is not the person who carries the fetus to term. If those are two different people, then which one of them is the halachic mother? And there's a fair amount of consensus that, in light of the fact that there's so much machloket about it and that we can't really figure it out, we should act under the presumption that both of them should be treated as the mother. So if that's the case, then we have to treat the surrogate as the mother, as the halachic mother of the child, even though there would be no genetic connection between the child and the surrogate. And then if the surrogate has other children, then the surrogacy child and the non-surrogacy child or children of this same woman would be considered kruvin, or be considered halachically related to one another, halachic siblings, even though they share no genetic material. Now, there are all sorts of rules that apply to kruvin. Low on the totem pole is that there are obligations like, burial and shiva and things like that. But most importantly, there's a prohibition of incest. Right? There's a prohibition of their marrying each other or sleeping with each other. And we'd run the risk that there could be people who maybe don't realize that they're related to each other. I should even say, it's not only a case of from one woman surrogacy children and non-surrogacy children, but multiple surrogacy children, right? Who similarly have no genetic connection, but perhaps halachically they're proven, they could end up marrying each other, not knowing that they're related to each other, not have no way of checking to see if they're related to each other, because they would have no overlapping DNA. This is a concern, I suppose. But A, it's still pretty rare. Like, there have been cases that have come up of folks who have managed to, try and marry someone, it turns out they actually, are kind of siblings by some metric, but it seems unlikely. And also, it all presumes that we are going to treat the gestational mother as the halachic mother. But if we choose not to, then we would say there's no such thing as non-genetic proof. Perhaps the central issue here is what's called the laws of Erevah. Is there a concern of Erevah? Meaning, is there something prohibited about a Jewish woman carrying within her a fetus that comes from someone that is not her own spouse? Arguably, if we have some notion of marital fidelity, that sex or childbearing, good question, how much they're related, we'll get to that, are meant to happen within the context of marriage, having a Jewish surrogate for, let's say, a Jewish couple means that there's more than two people in this story of the world of, of sex and childbearing. And maybe that already is a problem of Erevah. It's sort of tantamount to, like, one might say, we will look at other options, but it might feel a little like an extramarital affair. Right there, the man, right, has now caused it to be the case that his own sperm, or at this, or as it can be, the sperm or already an embryo, ended up into some other woman's body. Is that a problem? So for all of these reasons, Dr. Look and Rob Temler say the best thing to do is have a non-Jewish surrogate, because all these issues don't apply. The surrogate's own concern about the prohibition of self-injury wouldn't apply. The infidelity thing, they kind of just do a hand-wavy thing where they think it wouldn't happen with non-Jews, though I don't know what he means by that, but I don't care about I think the whole thing is a little bit forced anyway. But more importantly, in terms of the laws of Erva and producing non-genetic proving, if the surrogate is not Jewish, then the there halachically there isn't a relation between them. Right? The child would in theory be not would be born not Jewish, because that child is born to a non-Jewish mother, a non-Jewish gestational mother. And then we convert the child to make him Jewish, and then there's just no connection to the surrogate, and that's all celebration. So for that reason, it's very clear to Rav Tendler that the best thing to do is have a non-Jewish surrogate, and this is pretty much reflected by much of the halachic writing in the Anglophone world. What's surprising is what happens when we compare this to Israeli writing. So this is taken from the Pua website. Pua does a lot of work in the field of fertility, Nida, and the like, based here in Israel. And on their website, on their page about surrogacy, they write as follows. Even those who allow for surrogacy when necessary, it is only permissible to have a surrogate if the surrogate is an unmarried Jewish woman. Meaning not only is, I suppose Anglophone American writers are saying it's really strongly preferable to have a non-Jewish surrogate, comes in the Israeli voice that says it is only permissible if you have a Jewish surrogate. So that's a little odd. Now the footnote to this line and their guidelines are as follows: Harav Amar, Rav Shlomo Amar, previous chief rabbi, in a meeting in 2007 with Pua, which was in the aftermath of a ruling that he made as part of the Beit Din Rabbani in Israel in 2006. Says as follows, I'm reading in English. Rav Amar clarified that the order of preference for surrogacy is as follows. First, that the surrogate should be an unmarried Jew. If needed, it would be possible for the surrogate to be married, and if there's no alternative, the surrogate can be a non-Jew. So notice what happened. While we have American writers, and there are others as well, but while there are American writers, like Rav Tendler, who are saying that the preference is to have a non-Jewish surrogate, Rav Amar is saying that it is only in as a last resort that you can even consider having a non-Jewish surrogate. This is unusual. This is unusual. And the truth is, this is somewhat reflective of the ruling that he made in 2006, where even though the norm in Israel for a long time was to have only non-Jewish surrogates, he allowed for a Jewish surrogate. And this sort of falls on the heels of that. And the question is why? Now, preliminarily, Rav Tendler had offered a number of reasons why we might prefer a non-Jewish surrogate. It simplifies all sorts of issues, particularly regarding lineage, right? When we ask these questions of how do we make sense of lineage in a world in which you have plausibly two Jewish mothers, right? If you want to avoid all those issues, you could just have a non-Jewish surrogate and then we can just circumvent all the issues. Either the child is the child of the Jew, the Jewish genetic mother, or the child was not Jewish, so we convert them to make them Jewish, but then the connection to the non-Jewish gestational mother disappears, and it just makes things simpler. Why then would Rav Amar and quite a number of Israeli rabbis follow in line, why would they prefer that you have a Jewish surrogate? In fact, in the Chavos B'Yamin, Rav Sha'uli Sarebi writes that in the context of Jewish versus non-Jewish surrogates, he writes, Nosaf al Yisur Tza'ah HaZer Yesh Gam Yisur B'Hachnasan Zer Yisrael L'me'eh HaGoya Kivan She'asur La'apoch Zer Yisrael L'Goy. He says, separate from whether there's a concern about wasting seed that is part of how we might navigate these questions around surrogacy and fertility and so on, he says there's this prohibition. For the record, I've read the Chumash once or twice. I haven't come across it yet, but he claims there is a prohibition on inserting Jewish seed into the body of a non-Jew, because you will thereby take Jewish seed, Zer Israel, and turn it into a non-Jew, and that is prohibited. Meaning, even though your game plan is to, again, let's presume that the the egg donor, whether it's the intending parent or not, is Jewish, let's say. But you want to, you're taking the either the sperm or the whole embryo, placing it in, inserting it into the body of this non-Jewish person, and then they're going to be, that child will be born in your body, convert the child, and it'll be a Jewish child. The very fact that you took Jewish genetic material and then had it come out of how it be born not Jewish, that is forbidden. Whoa. This strikes me as a uniquely, I'm not going to mean uniquely, but a distinctly Israeli, I think, approach, particularly within the Zionist world. These having these sort of like very deep concerns about how we think about Jewish lineage and relationships between Jews and non-Jews. I think that a lot is actually reflective of this broader issue in much of halachic writing in Israel, and particularly the religious Zionist world, but really in much of halachic writing in Israel, related to the question of should Torah observance in Israel rely on non-Jews. There are those who would claim that it ought not be the case that in the independent sovereign state of the Jews, where Jews sort of, ostensibly run their own show, and just in a logistical sense, make up the majority of the population, depending on how one counts, then should it be the case that we need to rely on the assistance of non-Jews to perform these votes? So, for example, there are a lot of questions that emerge regarding the observance of Shabbat, in Israel, right, where in traditional accounts of halacha, there are all sorts of cases where we're saying, listen, if you're stuck, make use of the assistance of a non-Jew, what is called a goy shel Shabbat, a Shabbos goy. Right? There's that malacha that has to be done. There are ways too, if done appropriately, a non-Jew to the malacha for you. So you could rely on that in all sorts of cases, especially in Israel. How do you keep the police station going and the electrical plants running and the doctors hiring them to take their notes? And you could say, let's just have non-Jews all this stuff. But there's this void within and a large sector, I think, of halachic writing in Israel that says it can't be that the halachic solution to our problem is get the non-Jews to help. Now, you could call how one interprets that. That's already moving our way into the sociological and the political. But I definitely think that's something that's present and worth considering. But the same thing with Shemitah, right, where there are all these questions of in the first of all, is it okay to perform what's called the Heter Mechira, right? During the Shemitah year, it is in principle prohibited to do agricultural work in the land of Israel. But there's lots of agricultural work to be done in the land of Israel. So one option is to do what's called the Heter Mechira, where you sell off the entirety of the land to some non-Jewish owner. And there are some in Israel who are very opposed to this as a matter of principle. How can it be that the solution to our problems is selling off the land to someone who's not Jewish? What's more, on the original version of the Heter Mechira, really what it allows for is to then have only non-Jews work the land. And people say, it can't be that our solution is if we're going to have all the non-Jews come and do all the agricultural work. And I guess some of these comments sort of follow sort of the same lines. How much are we going to make use of the assistance of non-Jews in this performance? So I think part of what's notable about the current discourse on surrogacy is that my sense is that it is still the norm in outside of Israel that it is considered preferable to have a non-Jewish surrogate because it just allows you to circumvent some of these naughty areas of the halakha in terms of how we navigate lineage. And yet, there's also on the flip side in Israel more of a sense that we should prefer Jewish surrogates because of, and I think it stems from the sense of it can't be that the halachically preferable option involves getting non-Jews involved in the story. Now, you could also read this in a sort of more straightforward sense, which is it has nothing to do with values or one's approach to Zionism, and it really is about the supply chain. In the state of Israel, there are only so many surrogates available who don't identify as Jewish. And so for that reason, there's also just a pressure to allow for Jewish surrogates, while on the flip side, say, in, I don't know, the US or Canada, most of the available surrogates are going to be non-Jewish, so it's actually much easier to say that a non-Jewish surrogate is preferable. So all these factors certainly seem like they're at play. But I think it's really interesting to notice that changing. And I my sense of that there's also it's also reflective of a still like a developing change in the field in terms of people's experience or well sort of relationship with the surrogate. I think that right, they're trying to sort of mask over surrogacy. I think it was more popular in earlier phases of the modern history of surrogacy, such that, you have the support of a surrogate, but you pick up a baby, good question even how much you meet the surrogate, the parents who take the baby home, and then so that's it, the story ends there. And there's an emerging culture of, no, you kind of want to know who that surrogate is, or the child wants to know who that surrogate is, and whatever that relationship is. And because of that, I think there's some growing pressure in Israel that, okay, there's going to be this person who you isn't just, a black box somewhere in your history, but is someone who kind of you have some sense of relationship with, however that gets defined. Then there's more pressure for that to be someone who is from within the community, identifies as Jewish, and so on. So for all those reasons, I think that this is a real machloket, is it prevalent of a Jew or a non-Jewish surrogate, and the issue remains unresolved for all of these, again, emerging and still changing issues. That's point number one. Point number two is about choosing between a married surrogate and an unmarried surrogate. An unmarried surrogate certainly makes things easier. Again, let's presume we're talking about a Jewish surrogate. If a person is unmarried, then the concern about erva, or the concern about effectively committing adultery with the surrogate, is somewhat lessened, because in a sense we might say that adultery doesn't apply the same way. We're talking about a married man and an unmarried woman. Again, at least on a traditional approach to halakha. But there still is a question to be asked. Would it in theory be permissible for a married woman to be a surrogate? A married Jewish woman. And part of why this matters a lot is because as mentioned in the ASRM guidelines, and this is the norm, in the US, in Canada, and in the state of Israel, surrogates are expected or required to have carried a pregnancy of their own to term before becoming a surrogate. Now, it's possible to have a child without being married, but a significant number of people who have been pregnant in the past and carried a pregnancy to term are people who are married. And so if surrogates need to be unmarried, it significantly limits the pool of people who can be surrogates. Now, interestingly, the question of whether an un I'm sorry, the question of whether a married woman can be a surrogate is halakhically parallel to the question of whether one can use a sperm donor. I'll explain that. If there is a concern about, again, on a traditional kind of halakha, of a married woman, it is considered adultery when a married woman sleeps with any other man. Then if we think that the insertion of sperm or an embryo, I suppose, into the body count is tantamount to having sex, then that problem exists for a sperm donor. That's some other man to the married woman within a family, or in a case of surrogacy where there's the either just the sperm from the intending father or the embryo from both parents, which then goes into the body of this other woman, the surrogate. And so the whole conversations are parallel. And so some of what we're going to look at here comes from the one but applies to the other. So that's the question we have to ask. Does it count as adultery if the sperm of a man makes its way to the uterus of a married woman, a married Jewish woman, if it doesn't happen in the context of sex? This is a machloket. The person who carried the strongest view on this is the Satmara, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, who pointed to the following verse in Vayikra, "Ve'el isha nitecha lo titin shechov right in Vayikra chapter 18, there's the discussion of all the questions of incest, and in one of these psukim, in talking about adultery, the formulation that's used is And to your fellow wife, you shall not give over the seed of your copulation. Okay, bit of a clunky phraseology, but claims the Divrei Yoel that this would imply that where the prohibition lies is sperm getting into the womb. That's where the issue lies, whether or not it happens in the context of some sort of sexual act. And he points to the Ramban on this pasuk, who write, "V'ashar shamar lizera." Says the Ramban, the reason why this formulation is used here in this pasuk regarding adultery is that it points to what's wrong with adultery, which is, well, as someone will lose track of whose seed is whom, whose seed is whose, and this will lead to great abominations for everyone. By which the Ramban seemingly means that if we have no restrictions on whose genetic material ends up in whose body, then we have no good way to keep track of whose children belong to which parents. I'm sorry, which children belong to which parent. And so, if that's the case, then the problem of adultery and incest more broadly is not about the sex that happens, but is about the genetic material going from one body to another, such that it will be a problem in a case of surrogacy, in a case of sperm donation as well. On the flip side, a number of poskim, chiefly among them, Rav Moshe Feinstein, is sort of the first one to really, really push this view, think the opposite, and claim that there's the only prohibition when it comes to adultery or incest is having sexual intercourse between people who are prohibited to do so. But genetic material moving from one body to another is not where the problem lies. And he brings evidence from the Beit Shmuel. Beit Shmuel is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, who himself, really what's important is that he's quoting, I'll read inside, "Matzadi behagas smak yasham b'shem." Right, so the Beit Shmuel says that he saw in the smak that the smak said something that they were going to parrot. So this really is a chush of Rabbeinu parrots, an important Ashkenazi rishon from the medieval period. It goes as follows: Ishtanidayakov asedine ba'ala. And he says in principle, a woman who's in a state of nida is allowed to lie down on the sheets, the bed sheets of her husband. But women tend to be careful, he says, I'm just noticing this, women tend to be careful not to lie down on the bed sheets of other men, pentis, lest they accidentally get impregnated by another man's seed. Meaning, they're presuming that if there were to be semen on the bed, then it would be possible to get impregnated by that semen getting into the body, and that would be a problem. It would constitute adultery. Unlikely such a thing ever happened, or could happen, but they were nervous. So, there you have it. Says Rabbeinu Peretz, "Kevan de'in kan bi'at isur, havlab kasher l'gamri, afilu t'daver mishivat zera shel acher." He says, but honestly, since there was no forbidden intercourse in such a case, right, where this woman managed to get impregnated by semen that was on some bed sheets, again, kind of similar basically to a sperm donation, all right, IUI, he says that the child would be fine. The child would not have the status of a mamzer because there was no bi'at isur, there was no forbidden act of intercourse that would produce the mamzerut. He says, there might be still some other halachot that might get applied to this like funny case where you end up carrying or a married woman is carrying a fetus whose genetic father is not her own husband, called havchana, and right, which is making sure that we keep track of, with by whom she was impregnated. But the point is, the child would still be fine. So if this is the case in this unusual sort of sci-fi-y case from the medieval period, it should probably be true in our cases too. The prohibition of adultery, and related to the prohibitions of incest, only apply when there is a forbidden act of sex that happens, but not if sperm goes to a uterus, even if those people are not married to each other. And along these lines, just a quote from the Yabia Omer, from the Or Avadi Yosef, who writes, "It's Chorani Kizek Hasrim Shana, Biyoti Biyachad Bevit Hadin Hagadol Yerushalayim In Amitai Hagrisha Yeshiva Agrav Zolti." So he says, "I remember like 20 years back when I was on the Beit Hagadol Yerushalayim with my colleagues Rabbi Yashiv and Rabbi Zolti." Says Dibarnu Mezeh, we spoke about this issue. Vaya Pashut LeKulanu, it was clear to all of us. Shigamim Kibla Isha Zera Meisha Cherav Yada. If it were the case that a woman were to have seed, sperm from another man inside her and give birth, she'ain a vlad mamzer. The child is not a mamzer. Mikivan she'ain kan biyad yisur. There's no forbidden intercourse. Now, if this is the case, if we follow this line of reasoning, then there really should be no prohibition on a married woman being a surrogate. Right? If we say that there's no mamzer that is produced, then really married women should be allowed to be a surrogate. It's only if we're concerned about this possibility that maybe we have to consider it adultery, even when only genetic material passes over, without some sort of prohibited sex act. So why all the holdup in halachic writing about married women being surrogates? A lot of it stems from whether textually or at least conceptually from the argument point put forward by Rav Zalman and Chaim Goldberg. Here he writes about it in 1999, where he was asked about whether a married woman could be a surrogate, and he writes as follows. I'll read it in English. He says, "A child born to a married surrogate, when the father is not the husband of the birthing mother, risks suffering from a tarnished personal status." And he says, "Even if we conclude, along with another 100 rabbis, that there is no impermissibility in the case of a married surrogate, yet one rabbi or a few think otherwise, the child will be hurt." He writes, and this is reflected in a lot of the writing about this issue, where in terms of whether a married woman can be a surrogate, they won't say it's forbidden for a married woman to be a surrogate because it constitutes adultery. They'll say it's forbidden for a married woman to be a surrogate because even if it is the case that that someone thinks that it doesn't constitute adultery, since there is a view out there that it constitutes adultery and that the child is a mom there, it would be wrong of us to take a risk, to set up a scenario where a child might be considered a mom there by some people. And we don't want to run into that problem, right? It's just that the risk was too high. We face this machloket, whether it's permissible for a married woman to be a surrogate or not, because it might kind of fall under adultery, it might not. And so why risk it and have a child maybe be a mom there? To play it safe and not allow them. That could settle the issue, but there are reasons why it might not. And the truth is that if there is, as we've demonstrated, a halachic argument to be made for a married woman being a surrogate, that to say that it's not forbidden, then there are reasons why we might want to allow for such an arrangement. And that's because surrogacy is, if we look at the global surrogacy market, there are estimates that in the coming 10 years, the money that is produced within the surrogacy market could grow. I think it's something like tenfold. If you can see the estimates that offered here in the graph. There's a lot of money in surrogacy because surrogacy costs a great deal to pay someone to be a surrogate. And as we noted, in a lot of the developed world, there's a really high bar that's set to make sure that surrogates are being respected and are being cared, you know, aren't being exploited. Because of that, more often than not, when people want to pursue surrogacy, oftentimes they'll go to parts of the world where there's less legal and medical oversight. All right. So, here's just, the pull quote from this article from earlier in the year, in Georgia, as in Ukraine, commercial surrogacy firms cost around $40,000 to $50,000. In Mexico, $60,000 to $70,000. In the U.S., we're talking $120,000. Right? It costs much more to find a surrogate in, places like Canada, the U.S., and so on, where oversight is, sort of more rigorous than in other parts of the world. And because of that, there are all sorts of countries like Georgia and Ukraine, where India, Nepal, where there's a growing market for surrogates, where there's much, it costs less because there's much less oversight. And there are concerns that there are parts of the surrogacy industry where there is a fair amount of exploitation. And it's an offshoot of the fact that in places like the US, Canada, Europe, the standards are so high for who can be a surrogate that it pushes people to look to other places where the standards are lower and therefore it's cheaper. And if we were to lower the standards of who can be a surrogate within, these sorts of places where there's better medical and legal oversight, it might help to protect against the exploitation that happens in all these other parts of the world. Our people I'll share though, who back in 2013 sat on the advisory committee to the Knesset on formulating the law the law regarding surrogacy in Israel. And he at the time wrote about the importance of having a low threshold for surrogacy in order to protect surrogates, as well as to allow for families to be able to pursue family building. So he writes later on in 2015 in response to a report that had come out. He writes, "Humane treatment of surrogates in Nepal and being saved from poverty as a humane and justified endeavor cannot overcome the scandal of this entire form of surrogacy, which is unethical, illegal, and akin to slavery." He says, "There's some there." He says, "It's true that there, in this case, Nepal, who are getting a better life than they would have otherwise by being surrogate because $40,000, which in all likelihood only comes out to $12,000 they get, and the rest goes to the agency. It's better than what they would be getting otherwise, but you can't get around the fact that this is a huge case of exploitation." And because of this, it is worth wondering whether we have to reconsider the question of whether we should permit within our communities, within the state of Israel, and also within other Jewish communities, embracing the idea of married women being able to offer their services as surrogates, because lowering the standard, the thresholds within our own communities might help protect against the exploitation that happens around the world. And that may be a reason for us to consider that direction. So to review, what we looked at today is issues both of choosing between Jewish and non-Jewish surrogates and the way that that discourse is shaped by the norms in different parts of the world, Israel and elsewhere. And also the question of whether a married woman can be a surrogate, where there is some degree of halachic concern such that we might want to play it safe, but there's also a strong halachic argument to allow for it. And it's a question whether these broader concerns around the happenings in the world and the risks of exploitation that are a part of the surrogacy industry should push us to reconsider the question of whether we're willing to entertain married Jewish women functioning as surrogates. So that's what we wanted to cover for today. Next time we're going to talk about money. We've spoken a lot about these the how to go about these various kinds of assistance in family building, and all this stuff costs money, as we've been discussed today. Who's meant to foot the bill? In particular, what are the responsibilities of employers in terms of coverage for these kinds of treatment, and so on. So that's Bezrat Hashem, we'll be looking at next week. I'm stopping the share. I'll start with the chat to see if there are things that come up here, and then if we have a little time, we can we'll hear from what else people have to say before finishing up. Okay, so just going quickly through the chat. Suzanne, I know such a surrogacy case. They had twins, and one of the Mila naming I was clear to me. Yeah, for sure, a complicated issue. Yeah, thank you for agreeing with me, Susanna, that the infidelity issue is absurd. I don't know where he got this from. I think he heard of one story and it freaked him out, if I had to guess. Person non-Jewish coming doesn't. It would be hard to find non-Jewish surrogate. Yeah, okay, so issues as mentioned. So a point of sorry, yeah, Susanna.
Sorry. The business of that in, suspicion of infidelity or the man being attracted, I suspect he made it up.
Entirely possible. I don't know. He clearly was nervous about it. As I recall, he has a footnote where he says he has evidence that this has happened, and some psychologist said that it's a huge issue, but the evidence does not seem to point in that direction. What about a surrogate who's a family member? So I suppose, that we would have to ask the question very, the whether a family member can be a surrogate is basically the same as whether a married woman can be a surrogate. Meaning, if we think that there's the prohibitions on, when we talk about forbidden sexual unions in the Torah, that extends to getting, genetic material, let's say sperm, into a woman's body, that is prohibited. That's prohibited for adultery. A married woman is also prohibited for incest, right? Your relatives. If we say that no, the prohibition is only on having sex, but if you find some other way to get sperm into someone's body, then it doesn't count. Then it should be allowed. So it would rest upon the same machloket. Supply chain issue. I suspect there's some ethics chauvinism. Okay, so I didn't want to sort of hit that nail on the head too hard, but yes, there is definitely an ethnic question, a racial question in the background here in Israel, where people's relationships with the local non-Jewish population is different and is I'm gonna say different. I'm gonna try to use as much value neutral language as I can, at least for the time being. But yeah, I definitely presume that the ways in which Jews in Israel relate to the people around them who are not Jewish, and the way that Jews in other parts of the world relate to the people around them who are not Jewish, that is part of the story here about whom people are willing to have as surrogates. Okay, so the point about Tetelet Zera not being a sperm donation, I guess the claim there is that it's not that the Talmud is talking about sperm donation, but rather the formulation used in the Torah can help us appreciate that the underlying concern regarding forbidden sexual unions is the passage of sperm from this man to this woman, irrespective of how it gets there. That the concern is the sperm, not the sexual act. That's the claim being made, but again, I agree that it might be an overreading of the words of the Torah. I'm gonna sprinkling at least for ground around the ground that's given birth. Yeah, okay, as mentioned before. Okay, just in terms of how much of this is a legal requirement versus just kind of preferred, so many agencies have their own, certain agencies have a lot of power in this story. They have their guidelines, which are often modeled after the ASRM or similar standards. In Israel, it's all legal requirements. It's all over by the state. And in, I think in the US, it's state by state. I didn't check the deals in Canada. If I'm not mistaken, I think some of this is even legislated. I'm sorry, regulated legally in Canada, if I'm not mistaken, but worth double checking. Okay, all right. I think that's it from the chat. So we're already like past the hour, but if people have anything else just to share now briefly, I'd love to hear.
I have a question.
Please.
So, there is this term in halacha, karka ba'alma. It's come up
Yeah.
in, I can leave it to you to translate it, or I can do whatever I can with it. And basically it means like the status of a woman is transformed given an exigent circumstance. So, whatever her status is in some sort of a sexual mode, is transformed because of that circumstance, like, for example, a rape during war. Here, we seem to have now full knowledge of fertilization and genetic material and whatever that status is, and the fact that here we have a woman who is, in some ways, especially if we're talking about monies being paid, a disinterested party. And very much a third party. How much of that could influence the previous thinking about what the status is of the individual who's gestating?
Yeah, you're right to say that in the background of how we think about surrogacy halachically is not only a question of in what manner is surrogacy allowed or not allowed, but how what bearing might it have on how we think about other parts of childbearing. Right, so for example, right, there's this machloket, as we discussed previously, right? Who is the halachic mother, the genetic mother or the gestational mother? And we looked previously at in a previous session about how we might argue one way or the other. So there's a fellow by the name of Rabbi Tzvi Reisman, who argues that the advent of artificial wombs, in addition to the questions that artificial wombs raises, also would lead us to the conclusion that genetic mothers are halachic mothers and not gestational mothers, because evidently serving as a gestational environment is something that even a non-human can do. Like you can even do it with a machine. So it must be the case that the only mother that really counts as the mother is the genetic mother, right? So that would be a case where it's not only a local issue about artificial wombs, but how does that impact how we think about the system more broadly? And so I suspect that you're right. We have to do that with surrogacy also, where we have to call the question, what does it mean for us that we have these, for a person to be, you know, merely the incubator, so to speak, of the child, but not intend to be the parent or part of the marital relationship? How does that shape how we think about this, you know, the whole thing? And some of that I think is waiting to be determined, you know, as again, we as a society are still trying to figure out what modern surrogacy means for us. And what is the role of the surrogate in the story? Still to be seen. I'm seeing we're already 9:04, so I think we'll pause it here. Thank you everybody for bearing with us at the beginning as we're just working on the technicalities, and Bezrat Hashem, next week we'll have everything, ready to go already, on the hour, if not before. Thank you for being with us and looking forward to learning Torah with you next week again.